Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The man whose intelligence on many aspects of that war has been an inspiration to me and also to many others, as well as, I think, a great service to our country, is our first guest. He's Ambassador Henry Cooper. He served in a number of capacities in the United States Air Force in uniform and in the civilian side. He also was our ambassador to the missile and defense space talks under President Reagan. He has been a very active participant, both in government and in the years since at High Frontier, in the effort to protect our country against the sorts of threats that have emerged from Russia and China, and now are very much on our mind as a result of developments in even North Korea and Iran. It is a great privilege to have him with us to talk about developments of the weekend in particular and more. Hank Cooper, thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Let me ask you first and foremost to sort of characterize the threat that you see these days now, Hank, from North Korea, both with respect to the weapons that it can lob our way and the missiles with which it would do the lobbing.
Well, Frank, as you know, I've been telling people for quite a long time that North Korea and Iran both could set nuclear weapons that are on their satellites that approach the United States from the south, where we have poor, if at all, defenses, and set it off above the atmosphere and create an electromagnetic pulse that could, in fact, lead to an indefinite loss of electricity and consequently the death of most Americans within a year. What is new is that North Korea itself now has acknowledged that this is a part of their strategy. In public statements by their representatives in their state newspapers. So North Korea is acknowledging now that this is part of their game plan. And so far, the American people have ignored the warnings from us. I hope they'll pay some attention to North Korea's pronouncements.
I do too, Hank. It certainly is a daunting thought that this regime, which is widely recognized as among the most dangerous on the planet, has actually got the capacity to inflict that kind of damage on our grid and therefore on the rest of us, in fact, the country as a whole. There are some, however, who are poo-pooing that threat, including Siegfried Hecker, a man who was for a time the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. He's spent some time in North Korea, and I think some may be inclined to assign to him a certain credibility on this subject. What are your thoughts as a distinguished engineer with a long history of work in these fields, Hank Cooper?
Well, I knew Sig Hecker pretty well when I was running the SDI program, and of course, he was the director of Los Alamos at that time period, and they were among those who were working on SDI in a very constructive way. So his views at that time were more aligned with what my interests were. Today, I think he's completely out of step, not only with me, but by anybody, any technical person that would look at the evidence of what North Korea has already demonstrated, the reports from our intelligence community that they may have up to 60 nuclear weapons, the reports from the EMP Commission over a decade ago that the Russians had given, accidentally, they said, the design information and how to build super EMP weapons, which are low yield. You don't need the big yield weapon of the sort that perhaps they demonstrated in the recent test to create the EMP. DIA says up to maybe 60 now that they could put on satellites of the sort that they've already launched over the United States. So this threat is undoubtedly real, and I have no idea why SIG is downplaying it.
This comes at a particularly important moment because there is an effort afoot as we speak to essentially allow a vital national asset, the Congressional EMP Threat Commission, to go out of business. I know you have worked for many years with members of that commission, including its chairman, Dr. William Graham. Talk a little bit about the value of the work that this commission has done in the past, Hank Cooper, and why this is a moment, especially with nonsense like this coming out of Sig Hecker, we need its expertise and clarity more than ever.
I couldn't agree more with your last statement. Bill Graham is a personal friend. He was around and working in the 60s and 70s in various roles to develop our systems to harden against EMP. He and I were lieutenants together in those days, studying the effects themselves and the importance of defending against them. The DOE laboratories now, to go back to the theme I was on a moment ago, are misleading a bunch of people in that they are out doing research for money, I suppose, reinventing the things that we learned a half century ago. The EMP Commission has been a lonely voice telling people about this problem. Johnny Foster, who is now in his 90s, was a bomb designer and a third-ranking guy in the Pentagon when Bill and I were lieutenants in the Air Force. And he is very much concerned about this issue. He understands more about the problem than Sig Hecker does by any means. And the EMP Commission really needs to continue with folks such as him on board. What the House has done, Chairman Thornberry of the House Armed Services Committee has been behind this, is to disestablish this commission and sometime in the future reestablish a new commission. I think this is a terrible idea at this point in time. They should reestablish the commission, which goes out of business the end of this month. And if they want to prescribe how future commissioners should be appointed, as the people who deserve retirement now retire. But we should keep these people who have provided warning and have provided needed information on board.
Amen. Let's hope that this is something that comes out of the conference between the House and Senate. Hank Cooper, and your leadership in that regard is really appreciated at High Frontier and elsewhere. Let me ask you, you mentioned, and I neglected to speak to it in my initial introduction of you, but you ran the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, SDIO, under President George Herbert Walker Bush. You know a vast amount about these missile threats and how they can best be countered. What would you recommend be done immediately to try to enhance our ability to prevent North Korea, for that matter, other adversaries from threatening us with these sorts of missile attacks?
The first thing I would do would be to do a test of an AMRAAM, Advanced Medium Range Air-to-Air Missile, that's launched from our fighter aircraft. We have them stockpiled. They could be placed on our airplanes tomorrow if they have the order, and do a demonstration of one of them shooting down a missile being launched as it's going up in its boost phase. It simply traces the jet fuel that's coming out of the rocket instead of the jet fuel coming out of an airplane, which is the way it normally works. And it can do this job, demonstrate to the world that that can be done, and put them on patrol in international water just off the coast of North Korea. I think that's the first thing we could do that would have immediate deterrent effect. And at the same time, we ought to institute programs to empower our unpiloted aerial vehicles like the Raptor, which is produced by General Atomic in San Diego, to launch these kinds of interceptors in the future. They can remain on station longer. They can work from more distant locations, and with a higher speed interceptor, provide better capability.
And perhaps give us a boost phase shot at some of these missiles, which, Hank Cooper, as you've understood, is definitely the way to go. There's so much more to talk about. I appreciate your time today, Hank, and I hope that we'll have a chance to visit with you in the very near future. But thank you again for your leadership on the EMP Commission and this imperative of improving our missile defense capabilities. not only in the ways you've described, but also from space, as you tried to do under George Herbert Walker Bush. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Russ Dallin about developments in the Caribbean as well as Latin America and what it might mean for all of us here in the United States as well. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Russ Dallin, the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets. He has served as the president of Venezuela's The Daily Journal, spent a long time in that country, and has covered from it and now from Miami area the developments in our hemisphere that are of enormous importance, especially at the moment, some of them of simply the very natural kind of development, horrific hurricane by the name of Irma. Russ Dallin, I know you are personally involved in literally battening the hatches at the moment, so I appreciate very much you taking a few minutes to talk with us about, among other things, what are the atmospheric conditions in your part of the world, as well as those of a geostrategic kind in the hemisphere. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Secretary. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So just quickly, from your outpost there and the reporting that you're receiving, Russ Dallin, talk a little bit about this Hurricane Irma, which has now been working its way over and through some of the islands of the Caribbean and seems now headed for landfall in the South Florida area where you are in the next few days.
It is indeed a beast. It is one of the largest formations that we've ever had. I've been following hurricanes for quite some time. My father was in the Air Force in the unit that actually was the hurricane hunters. Not that he was in that unit, but that he was at that same base. This one is wide and tall as Florida. So if it hits Florida, there's no place to run. And it is slowed down a little bit as of the 8 o'clock briefing this morning from 185 miles an hour winds to 180 miles an hour winds, which is not terribly significant. And what the really scary part is that it looks like it's heading directly for Miami and South Florida. And there are a number of cranes building tall buildings in downtown Miami. There's always construction on condos and office buildings. They're not built to withstand 185 miles an hour winds, and you just can't take them down. So they're about to become battering rams if this hurricane maintains this strength and hits Miami full on.
And Russ, we've already seen some of the damage a storm of this magnitude has been able to inflict upon islands like Antigua and Barbuda. We are told that they are essentially destroyed as a result of this storm. Aid is beginning to be volunteered from other parts of the hemisphere. I was struck by the fact that even Venezuela is apparently offering to provide some kind of assistance to some of these states. Remind us of where things stand in Venezuela, again, subject to the kind of man-induced destruction under the Chavez and Maduro regimes rather than the atmospheric kind, Russ. But what's the latest on that score?
Venezuela continues to deteriorate. It continues to be a mess. It is an oxymoron that they're offering aid to Barbuda. By the way, in Barbuda, the strongest buildings were the civil buildings, the police department, and the fire department. Those buildings were wiped out. Those were the strongest buildings on the island. Venezuela, by the way, has also offered $5 million in aid to Texas because of Harvey. Just to let you know, of course, it's money that they don't have, and they deny that they have a humanitarian crisis in their own country where the average wage is about $10 a month now, which is not enough to feed your family on.
Desperate straits for many there, for sure. And is there any sign that the political crisis that has precipitated this economic disaster is any closer to resolution?
I'm afraid not. There is the prospect of elections next month, although they haven't set a date. Imagine they're going to have regional elections for the 23 governorships after they disqualify most of the opposition from being able to run. But they haven't even bothered to set a date for it yet. I guess when they disqualified everybody and they need to disqualify, then they can have an election.
This brings us to a man who has taken an interest in the Venezuelan crisis, but has not been terribly effective in it. He's actually now in Colombia, and that would be Pope Francis. Tell us a little bit about why Pope Francis is spending several days now, I believe, in the course of this week, in the various parts of Colombia, Russ, and what the implications are for that country and perhaps for others in the region as well.
Aside from tending to the large Catholic flock that is there, the Venezuelan bishops have also gone over to Colombia to meet with him and explain the situation in Venezuela, and are trying to push for Caritas, one of the Catholic charities, to push Maduro to let in the Catholic charities. You're talking about a population that has no food, has no medicine, can't afford medicine, even if there was some available. You're watching what was one of Latin America's most advanced societies return to the Stone Age.
And in Colombia, what I gather the Pope is about is promoting this deal with the FARC. Is that, in fact, his mission? And he helped broker it, of course, in Cuba. Remind us of the actual upshot of the deal that was struck with these narco-traffickers and terrorists.
Yes, well, they've... not only that, by the way, before we go into the FARC, the President Santos of Colombia has negotiated a temporary peace deal, at least with the ELN, which is the little brother on the Marxist revolutionary tree in Colombia. So they have a temporary ceasefire while they work out perhaps a similar plan to the FARC. But basically, what happened is they've given the FARC exoneration for all their crimes, the murders and killings and destruction and kidnappings. Not only have they given them exoneration from that, they have also given them a number of seats in the assembly, the National Assembly, the Congress of the country, and so that they can become a political party and try and enter into the political regime and win elections in the same way that Hugo Chavez brought narco-traffickers to the front of Venezuela.
Yeah, and with the devastating effects that we've just been talking about. Hey, Russ, very quickly, one of the things that you and I have discussed over the past few months has been, I think you alluded to it a moment ago, the likelihood that one of the upshots of Venezuela's terrible state of affairs is that Russia will obtain control of refineries in the United States. In the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, we've seen some of those going offline, refineries that is. Is there reason to be concerned that the Russians would take them offline for economic warfare purposes, something that has now, we're seeing price spikes of gasoline, something that would be replicated in spades should that happen, I would think.
That is always a possibility. It's not the highest probable. Amazingly, we've been tracking the Russian shipments. You know, while Rosneft is a sanctioned company on OFAC, on OFAC Treasury list of sanctioned companies, and led by a sanctioned individual in Igor Session, they are not sanctioned from exporting oil to the United States. So we have been tracking last month, for example, there was a huge upshot rise in the amount of oil coming from Venezuela, but was actually consigned by Rosneft. So we're paying Rosneft and the Russians for the money that they're loaning and investing.
Another form of underwriting of this horrible Maduro regime. Russ Dallin, so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing so on the other side of the storm that is now descending on you. Needless to say, you and your family and colleagues at the Latin American Herald Tribune and others are in our prayers and in our thoughts. Next up, we will be speaking with Mark Krikorian about another kind of storm. Maybe it's Hurricane Daka. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined, I'm very pleased to say, by one of the go-to guys in Washington, D.C. when it comes to matters involving, well, immigration and border security and enforcement of the laws that bear on these issues. He is the executive director of an indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. His name is Mark Krikorian. You have seen him in all the right places, including commenting as best he can on what Donald Trump has done with respect to this program called Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, better known as DACA. Mark Krikorian, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to try to help walk us through what Donald Trump hath wrought in the past 24 hours. I compared this to what it would have looked like if King Solomon had actually split the baby, because it certainly seems as though that's what we've kind of got now, is one very substantial mess. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to carry that metaphor to a gruesome conclusion, but it's more like King Solomon putting the baby in a blender. I mean, it's a complete mess, because the first thing that the president did on Tuesday in announcing the wind down of DACA was, you know, long overdue, and I think put together prudently and sensibly. DACA is an illegal program that Obama instituted, a two-year renewable amnesty, which he did when Congress wouldn't do it lawfully and there was an election approaching. So for political expediency, even though he said he couldn't do it, he did it.
He said it repeatedly he couldn't do it, that it would be unconstitutional, correctly.
Right. Donald Trump had campaigned on getting rid of it, said he'd get rid of it on day one. He didn't. I guess he meant day one of the school year, or day one of September or something like that. But the point is, better late than never. And he gave Congress a six-month grace period before anybody's work permit expired to do their job and come up with some kind of legislative package. And the White House talked about adding things like E-Verify or changes in chain migration law, that sort of thing, as well as, you know, wall funding in some kind of package. Okay, well, so far, so good. The problem is then that very night, literally just a few hours later, he then tweets out that if Congress doesn't do anything in 6 months, well, he'll revisit the issue, whatever that means. It's not clear what that means, but the only way Congress was ever going to do anything is if they had a deadline. And with that one tweet, he undid the deadline that he had just set that very morning. It was, I'm beginning to suspect he'd hired a ghostwriter to write the art of the deal, because this is not the way you make a deal, by negotiating with yourself on day one.
Well, of course, this has been somewhat overshadowed by the very controversial decision he made with the folks he's now calling Nancy and Chuck, Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer, respectively, the minority leader of the House of Representatives and the minority leader of the Senate. These are people who have obviously had the better of President Trump, it seems, on repeated occasions, but particularly in this exercise involving the debt ceiling and, you know, funding for the government operations for the next 3 months. But when all is said and done, Congress is presumably, if I'm not mistaken, Mark Krikorian, going to do something about this DACA program and perhaps immigration reform of an unspecified nature more generally. Looking in your crystal ball, what do you expect is going to in fact emerge from this this blenderized arrangement?
I mean, at this point, maybe nothing would be the best option, but there's kind of the worst-case scenario and best-case scenario if something gets passed. The worst-case, absolute worst-case scenario is they simply pass a naked amnesty for the people who have DACA. In other words, with no offsetting other measures, nothing, just a straight-up amnesty. That, I think, is probably unlikely, because I don't think even the Paul Ryan folks in Congress who are, you know, open borders in their hearts, but they can't really be that way. Even they wouldn't vote for that because it's politically problematic. The somewhat less bad, but still very bad result would be they pass an amnesty and bundle it with a little bit of money for the wall and maybe a little money for extra detention facilities, something like that. In other words, almost fig leaves that don't really do very much. The best case scenario is they combine an amnesty for the DACAs, which I'm for. I mean, I'm a squish on this. If they actually grew up here, I think there's a case you can make for a mercy case, basically, for them. But any amnesty has two consequences. One, it attracts illegal immigration, new illegal immigration in the future. And two is it has these downstream chain migration, legal immigration consequences. So the best case scenario, in my opinion, is they pass an amnesty for the DACAs, relatively straightforward, rip off the Band-Aid, get it over with amnesty. But as part of it, they mandate the E-Verify system. That's that online system that helps businesses actually know whether the people they're hiring are lying to them about who they are and whether they're authorized to work. And changes along the lines of Senator Cotton's RAISE Act, RAISE, like give a raise to people, which would, among other things, focus family immigration just on husbands, wives, and little kids. So it doesn't have this constantly metastasizing chain of relatives. And that's important here because if you're going to amnesty these people, what you'd be doing is then creating whole new migration chains for decades into the future. Right.
And a further magnet for migration as well, of course. So, Mark, one of the most troubling pieces of all of this was, as you said, that the president, having made, at least in the form of his attorney general, a principled argument that Obama was right initially when he said he didn't have the constitutional authority to implement DACA, and that the thing had to be sent to Congress if there is going to be any kind of program along these lines. What do we make of the fact that he said he would revisit it? If Congress does indeed respond, as you say they likely will, which is not to act within the deadline because now he's going to fix it all by himself, doesn't that put us into the position of this president also doing something unconstitutional about DACA?
Oh, absolutely. Although he is constrained in what he can do because DACA really is being wrapped up. They stopped taking new applications for DACA as soon as they announced it, which is something they should have done 10 minutes after he took his oath of office in January. They also have said, and this gets lost in the news, that if you have a work permit, because that's what DACA is really, is a work permit. If you have that and it expires in the next 6 months, you need to apply for renewal now before October 5, and that after October 5, there is no more DACA, no more applications, nothing. Whatever you have continues until it expires. So 5 months after that is when the deadline that he set, when people's work permits will start expiring, he can't really start up DACA again unless he specifically, explicitly goes against his own attorney general's legal opinion that DACA is unconstitutional. And I don't think he can do that. I think that tweet was really just the president freelancing and wanting, Nancy and Chuck to feel good about himself.
And Ivanka.
And Ivanka, yeah, exactly.
We're almost out of time. Just very quickly, let me ask you, Mark Krikorian. There is a suit now that's been filed in the aftermath of this decision by Washington State and 14 others that are basically claiming, look, this is just a case of anti-Mexican bigotry on the part of the president. What would your response to that be?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's a frivolous lawsuit. The judge actually should fine the, sanction the people bringing this lawsuit. California is going to bring one too because it's absurd on its face. The president is ending with a memo an illegal program that was created with a memo. It wasn't a law. It wasn't even an executive order. It was just a memo. There is no grounds for a lawsuit. Unfortunately, in the Ninth Circuit, you probably can find some judge who doesn't really believe in law anymore and thinks that he is the law. So there's a real danger here, at least that would be held up. But the Supreme Court can't uphold this kind of lawsuit. I mean, like I said, this is even more frivolous than most of these lawsuits that the lefties file. Unfortunately, in this post-law, post-constitutional world that we're in, just because the lawsuit is ridiculous on its face doesn't mean it can't win, at least temporarily.
To the contrary, it may at least make it through the federal courts up to the Supremes. We'll follow it closely with your good help. Mark Krikorian, thank you for what you do at the Center for Immigration Studies and through all the outlets that you employ to try to keep us smart about these issues. We pray that there will be a good outcome at the end of all of this. Next up, Matt Brodsky joins us. We'll talk with him about North Korea and also the axis between it and the Middle East and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Matt Brodsky, one of the bright young stars working on national security with a special expertise on threats that are developing from places like the Middle East and, of course, at the moment, most especially, North Korea. Matt has been writing on these subjects for years now, including prominently recently at Wikistrat and also at National Review. He is a senior Middle East analyst, in fact, at Wikistrat, as well as a senior fellow of the Strategic Studies Group. He is a man we've turned to frequently to try to get a read on some of the developments that are of such concern. And in particular, I'm pleased to talk with him about what's been happening with North Korea. Matt, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me.
Great to be with you.
I'm interested. We're doing a sort of conversation with a number of people with different perspectives on the North Korean threat at the moment, but we typically are preoccupied with what is in our face, whether it's a missile launch or now a nuclear test or a threat of an electromagnetic pulse attack against the country, all of which are tremendously important, of course, but I did want to just kind of level set with you about what is going on inside this country. What is the nature of the regime we're confronting in Pyongyang under this dictator Kim Jong-un?
First of all, it treats its people, as a report from a few years back in The Guardian recalled, that basically they're treating the people like Nazis. It's very much a live concentration camp there. And the regime is hell-bent on getting weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, it already has perfected nuclear technology domestically. And there's very little on the horizon that can stop them from by way of sanctions. And unfortunately, there's a large cadre of analysts out there who believe that, you know, we should just work on a deterrent strategy and basically welcome them in into the club of mutually assured destruction, which I would argue is a horrible thing.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that in a moment, but just staying with the nature of the regime, I've got kind of a working theory, Matt Brodsky, that any regime that treats its own people abysmally, and that doesn't begin really to describe what it's doing to the people of North Korea. They are, as you say, kind of in a national gulag. Some literally, and the rest of them certainly in a slightly less formal way, but just horrifically oppressive to its people. They're unlikely to treat everybody else, including our people, any better. So if that's so, it brings us to the question that you just touched on. Can we, in fact, deter a regime from engaging in the sorts of things that it's discussed just this weekend, which, as Hank Cooper said earlier in the program, could destroy the United States, perhaps with a single nuclear weapon detonated in space, if we simply are threatening to destroy their people? They don't seem to give a damn about their people, so could mutual assured destruction actually operate?
Yeah, of course. That's precisely the point. That won't deter them in much the same way that you look at their strategic partner, Iran, and, you know, the claim of annihilation can be working as an inducement and not as something that deters, you know, depending on their view of Shiism.
That afterlife thing particularly, yeah. Not sure that that's going on in North Korea, but certainly it is with Iranians who think they'll get to paradise more quickly and more surely this through this mass annihilation strategy.
I'm just saying that the point there is that neither of these two places represent what the United States has had with the Soviet Union. It's totally different mindsets in both places. And in North Korea, yeah, they don't care about the people. If it's not just us deterring them on their nuclear weapons, the fact is they are massive proliferators to other really bad rogue regimes who are against the United States. And that presents a whole cascade of problems.
It does indeed. You spoke a moment ago about the strategic partnership between Iran and North Korea. We'll be talking more about it in a moment with Fred Flights, but I would like to get your thoughts on this. You've recently written a piece at National Review, Matt Brodsky, about North Korea's axis in the Middle East, including with Iran, but also with its proxy Syria, Hezbollah, of course, consumers, it would appear, of the weapons of mass destruction programs that are, for Kim Jong-un, I think unquestionably, cash crops. Talk a bit about that relationship and the dangers that it poses to, among other places, Israel.
And there is a UN report that was reported in Reuters that during the past 6 months, there have been two shipments from North Korea that were going to the exact same agency in Syria, and they were intercepted. Then you go to the understanding that last night, Israel apparently destroyed a chemical weapons facility that is inside of Syria, and it's in Hama, not near Aleppo, but and took that place out. And that was poised again to be giving weapons from Syria to Hezbollah. And obviously, Israel has red lines, and that's one that they're not going to allow to be crossed. But it's a very long, decades-old relationship between Syria and between North Korea. And we already know a lot about the relationship between Iran and Syria.
Right. One other example of that relationship between Syria and North Korea, of course, was the construction in Syria of essentially an identical copy of the plutonium processing plant, I believe it was, that a reactor that the North Koreans had ostensibly put out of business and then brought back on stream as a result of, sort of our extensive diplomatic dance with them. But the Israelis also took that out, thank God. But it really just underscores your larger point, Matt Brodsky, that this is if not the most dangerous regime on the planet, certainly one of them. And if it has any rivals for that distinction, such as it is, it's actively working with them as well. Very frightening thing. Hey, Matt, just more generally, in the few minutes we have left, would you talk about how this looks from Israel's point of view? Obviously, it's got red lines and it's taking actions to protect them. But is there now in Israel a growing alarm at the state of the presence in Syria of the Iranians, and not just Hezbollah, but actual, Revolutionary Guard elements as well?
Absolutely. The fear in Syria from Israel's perspective is Iran, and frankly, a U.S. policy that has not addressed that really at all.
Except to have emboldened and enabled it, one could argue, under the Obama administration.
Exactly. That, yes, but so far, we've been locking in that type of policy in Syria, not broadly throughout the Middle East, but in Syria, if you were to look at Israel's perspective, that would be the case. And more problematic from their perspective is that if it were just Iran forces, if it were their forces on the ground that they had to deal with, then okay, that's something they can deal with from the air. It's Russia and their bases and their anti-aircraft equipment that is the problem. The fact that Russia built a very important air base as soon as they got into Syria in September 2015. This is why Israel reportedly launched their weapons from Lebanon and not into Syria, because these chemical weapon facilities and the moving of Assad's air force to this Russian base after President Trump did his Tomahawk missile strike, this is all to remain under the Russian air umbrella. And that puts Israel in the position of going to Russia to find out its room to maneuver, not Washington.
Fascinating and very concerning, needless to say. Matt Brodsky, thank you very much for the time today and the work that you do at Wikistrat. We're delighted to have you with us and hope that you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Fred Flights, as promised, about, well, all of this, North Korea, Iran, and what's going on inside our own intelligence committees, and much more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Fred Flights, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs. Fred is, of course, a career intelligence professional, having spent some 20 years at the Central Intelligence Agency, also was the Chief of Staff for Ambassador John Bolton, then an Undersecretary in the State Department, and subsequently became one of Congressman Pete Hoekstra's right-hand men on the staff of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He is the author of Obama Bomb, the Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, among many pieces at National Review, Newsmax, Fox News, and elsewhere. Fred, so good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
Well, I know you're following very closely, as you have throughout your career, what North Korea is up to. We talked a little bit about it with Hank Cooper earlier in the program. I'd be interested in what we should do about the North Korean missile and nuclear weapons threat, metastasizing as it is, Fred. The Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, is talking about, as has President Trump, sanctions on China's trade with the United States if it doesn't shape up and really start curtailing trade with the North Koreans. Is that a good idea? And either way, what else should we be doing?
Well, we really need to think through, where is North Korea getting the advanced technology that it used to make a nuclear bomb that may be a hydrogen bomb? Clearly, it's getting technology from other countries. There have been many reports that China is getting technology possibly through barter from China. There was a very compelling Wall Street Journal article today that North Korea is sending large numbers of students to study advanced physics in China. That they're basically, this is, and this is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. They're learning how to make nuclear weapons in Chinese universities. This is something that has to be cracked down on. And finally, there is evidence that North Korea has agents all over the world and probably was able to get an advanced rocket engine that was fired in July from a Ukrainian rocket factory using Russian smugglers. And this is so bad, the Ukrainians have barred all North Koreans from their country. This is such a problem. So there's a lot we have to do here.
What you've exposed really is the degree to which, without the active support of the Russians and, of course, most especially the Chinese, this threat would be an altogether different thing, if not non-existent altogether. It raises an interesting question, Fred. Another country, again, that you've spent a lot of your professional career tracking and warning about is Iran. The relationship between the Iranians and the regime of Kim Jong-un is a source of abiding speculation, I guess, but also of concern. If indeed, and I know you're still somewhat skeptical about this, but if indeed the North Koreans have now developed and tested a hydrogen bomb, whatever it is, it's considerably more powerful than anything they tested previously. But let's just say, for the purpose of discussion, it is an H-bomb, Fred Flights. What's the likelihood that that's going to be in the hands of the Iranians in fairly short order?
I think we have to assume the worst. We know that there's been very close collaboration in developing ballistic missiles between North Korea and Iran. Iran got almost all of its ballistic missile technology from North Korea. It improved some of it, and North Korea benefited from those improvements. We know a senior Iranian nuclear scientist has been at least one North Korean nuclear test. And I think we have to assume the worst, that this technology is being shared with Iran, and Iran is helping finance North Korea's nuclear program. We know Iran has helped finance North Korea's missile program. It actually would invest in missiles in the 80s and 90s, so it would have the option to buy them if the missiles worked. And that might be going on with the nuclear program.
If it is going on with the nuclear program, and frankly, I can't imagine anything else, the question is, are there measures in place that would actually prevent the Iranians from getting physical hardware or even more likely, at least the know-how to assemble a thermonuclear device based on what their North Korean allies have been doing?
My guess is that North Korea is not providing physical weapons to the Iranians. It would be worried about being caught. But I think they're probably providing the know-how. I wouldn't be surprised if they're training Iranian scientists. And at the same time, I wonder if the Chinese are training Iranian scientists. They're training North Korean nuclear scientists.
It's all, you know, cash crop as far as these guys are concerned, so it stands to reason. Fred, there's two other stories that I wanted just to touch on quickly with you. We are, of course, as we speak, awaiting word of what Donald Trump Jr. might have said to members of the congressional investigations into this so-called Russian collusion in the 2016 election. There is a story out that the folks at CNN, which have been breathlessly promoting the idea that there's a terrible scandal here, actually pulled off of their own investigation into this subject, the team that they had assembled for the purposes of covering it. Is this evidence, further evidence, really, of the fake news phenomenon? And what do we make of this story at the moment?
It sure is evidence of fake news. And lo and behold, CNN dug and dug and dug, and they found out what you and I have been saying for over a year. There's nothing here. There's no collaboration between the Trump campaign and the Russians. This is something that the Democratic Party and the media has been pushing because they're mad that Trump won the election. And the CNN dug to the end of this. They can't find anything else.
And so it's not exactly case closed, I guess. I'm sure they'll be reporting on what Donald Jr. says. But I have to say, my assessment of this is as yours is, that this has been much ado about not very much. It's not to say that there won't be further prosecutorial efforts, certainly on the part of Robert Mueller. But we'll be watching very closely to see if there's any there either. Finally, Fred, as I mentioned, you've been a member of one of those investigatory or oversight committees, the House Intelligence Committee. What are you inclined to make of this report that a third of the staff of it and its sister committee in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, are drawing upon staff members who have come out of agencies, as you did, the CIA. Is that an inherent conflict of interest or not a problem, as you see it?
Well, I'm glad you asked about this. The reporter was trying to get me to say that intelligence agencies are controlling the oversight committees. I said, well, from my experience, that's not true. But let me tell you something I told him. When I was on the committee, the CIA tried to pressure me to support its incorrect analysis about the Iranian nuclear program. And I said, look, if you're trying to twist the arm of a former analyst who's on the oversight committee, what are you doing to current analysts to stick to a corporate line? The reporter included that in the story. And I think we have to recognize these intelligence agencies are trying to influence the work of the committees, including by pressuring the staff. That's what I would take out of this article.
Well, and it speaks volumes to your own integrity, Fred Flights, that you stood up to it and would have none of it. I guess the question recurs, are others perhaps less independent, less resolute in the face of that kind of pressure? But your point is certainly well taken, that people who are still in the employ of the agencies that they're supposed to be, you know, working for, may well be subject to political manipulation and a kind of coercion. The sort of stuff we count on you to cover for us, Fred Flights, here at Secure Freedom Radio, as well as through the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy more generally. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.